Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day, gladdies and potties. The reason I'm poised up here on the top of the Harbour Bridge on this inclement night is because the midterm results from the US have me wondering whether or not it's worth living, and I may hurl myself into the abyss at any second. In fact, if you listen carefully, there's a group of my critics down there chanting, jump, jump, jump. I hope, however, that Bruce Shapiro will talk me down by explaining that there's a good side to all this. That'll test his abilities. You might remember the other night we were having a discussion, if it could be called that, on the Koori court system, and I terminated it with extreme unction because it didn't meet the first requirement of this program, which is that discussions are had with civility. And if we don't agree with each other, we treat each other decently on the program. So anyway, that's what I did, and there's been a lot of emails saying, please come back to the subject. So yes, we will, and tonight you'll be hearing from Judge John Smallwood. Then, do you remember that splendid little film of called Rabbit Proof Fence, Phil Noyce's film? It revealed the full power of A.O. Neville, WA's chief protector, funny word, of Aborigines, to decide the fate of all Indigenous folk under his care. For 25 years, from 1915, he carried out policies of forced settlement, the removal of kids from their mothers, surveillance, punishment and discipline. But there were other... Oh, and incidentally, when the film came out, there were those warriors in the history wars who said that it was very unfair that Neville was, in fact, a very fine fellow. Well, he wasn't alone in having this sort of power and carrying out those sort of policies. And tonight on the program, you will meet his Queensland counterpart. But first, Mr. Shapiro, are you going to join me in jumping?
Well, I did manage to be in Canada this week for a conference in Montreal, and we'll have to make a decision about whether to go home. I don't think it's necessary to jump. I think it's still possible that in 2 years it will be the Republicans who find themselves atop a bridge making the same choices. But there's no doubt that this has been a convincing and in some ways unprecedented Republican sweep of Congress. I mean, look, if you look at the map right now, if you look at the map in the red and blue pattern of who controls Congress, you see
after all these years, you of all people should know that this is radio.
Well, you look at those maps and you see red through the Midwest, blue on the coasts. It's going to be a long 2 years. It was an interesting, very interesting night. If you look at the numbers, the Democrats can do more than just cry. They can look first at history. Bill Clinton and Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan all suffered humiliating midterm congressional losses. And indeed, listeners with long memories will remember that when Newt Gingrich and the Contract with America swept Congress in 1994, everyone was predicting that Clinton would be done in 96. Instead, you got a couple of years of gridlock, and Clinton came back with a resounding victory. You can also look at the emerging turnout numbers. It appears that this Republican victory in the Midwest and South in particular was owed to blue-collar, low- and lower-middle-class white men who are a constituency the Republicans have been courting and working to rouse ever since Richard Nixon's silent majority in the 1968 and 1972 elections. And on the other hand, key Democratic constituencies stayed home in big parts of the country. African Americans, the young voters who did so much to bring Obama into office 2 years ago, and women didn't vote in such large numbers. In the places where they did, a couple of places where they did, New York, where Andrew Cuomo swept into the governor's office, Connecticut, where we have a real nail-biter for the governor's race that it appears the Democrat has won, and where Richard Blumenthal handily defeated the wrestling mogul Linda McMahon in the Senate race, or Harry Reid in Nevada beating Sharon Engel in the most closely watched Senate race in the country. There, Latinos, African-Americans voted in large numbers, high minority turnout in those areas, and that suggests something strategic to the Democrats, I think. That should say to the Democrats, don't overread the data in the thinking that you just have to craft your message for a new political climate. Instead, focus on core constituencies. I think there's a lot of course, Monday morning quarterbacking among Democrats, but that message is going to come through in the numbers and will come through in strategy, I think.
Is there any chance now that the Republicans, and let's call this aggregation Republicans, although that's an oversimplification given the fracture lines within them, within that side of politics, is there any chance that they will try to rescind, say, the health bill?
Well, remember this. Republicans control the House. They don't control the Senate. The Republicans face a strategic choice. The Tea Partiers, the Sarah Palin faction, the Rand Paul faction, who did very well the other night, have promised to try to rescind the health care bill. They can try that. It will result in massive gridlock because it would take both houses of Congress to rescind the thing. That's not going to happen, and then Obama could veto any legislation rescinding the health care bill. There certainly are not enough votes to overrun a veto. They will do that, and it can result in very polarizing rhetoric that runs a risk for the Republicans. It runs the risk of seeming to contribute to the very Washington paralysis that sent many of these voters, many of the Tea Party voters, to the polls. So it's a dilemma. And on the other hand, there's a more intellectual policy-wonking right and a corporate right and a wealth right that is behind a lot of the money that went into this election that may instead be focused on tax cuts or on other measures which these constituencies have sought. That more intellectual right would like to appear to be working with the president, to be working to govern, because the question in 2012 is not going to be who has the best laugh line on tax cuts or health care. It's going to be who should govern. And the language of the Tea Party movement thus far, which was successful getting people elected, is not going to be successful in governing. So the Republicans have a big dilemma, and they have these big fault lines. Yes, they can try to repeal health care. That's not going to happen. That's not going to get them anywhere. So what is the positive agenda Republicans are going to try to promote? There's an actual philosophic divide now.
You know, this will come as a great shock to you, Bruce, but in Australia, and no one ever really admits to this, a federal Labor government, let's hypothesize that there's a federal Labor government, might in fact be quite pleased if a state Labor government loses an election, takes a hit, because it, you know, just gives them some breathing space, and the argument is the electorate have emotionally exhausted themselves by so doing. This is, of course, Obama's big hope, isn't it, that they'll simply squabble and fight and be ridiculous and won't get their act together. They won't have the discipline that we've seen them maintain thus far for the first 2 years, and he can reap the benefits.
Well, not only that, but this victory moves... I think the sort of center of the struggle, the center of the struggle between Democrats and Republicans, to terrain on which Obama is more comfortable. It moves it onto the ground of social vision and political rhetoric. I think we may well see emerging in the next few months the Obama who campaigned, the Obama of, in 2008, the Obama of the grand speech about the social contract, the Obama who appeals to citizens to engage in a particular way. For whatever reasons, that Obama disappeared in the complexities of governing with a majority party, the complexities of actually being able to achieve stuff, which meant that you had to curtail your rhetoric, work with the factions of your party. Now it moves onto the terrain of the symbolic, and Obama has a chance to reawaken and remotivate a constituency that looked for him in this election cycle and in this period of time and so often found that Obama missing. So I think, yes, there are important opportunities for Obama created by this polarizing atmosphere in which there will be a lot of angry rhetoric but very little that can actually get done.
Okay, the who didn't win amongst the Tea Party nutters were the conspicuous failures.
The most important failure was Sharon Engel, who was running against Harry Reid in Nevada. And that was quite close race. It was a real nail biter up until the last minute. I have to say that there are a fair number of Democrats who may be privately disappointed, or at least divided, not disappointed that they've held on to a very important Senate seat, which would have been a disaster to lose, but because if it means another few years of Reid as majority leader, that's a disappointing outcome for some Democrats who find him very technocratic and dry and uninspiring, and that's an interesting one. But that was a major defeat for the Tea Party folks. Certainly, in New York, Carl Palladino, the Republican and Tea Party candidate for governor, defeated himself. I think it's safe to say there have been plenty of Republican governors of New York, but Palladino went out of the way to be erratic and offensive on many fronts. Christine O'Donnell was of course the Tea Party pinup girl, and she in Delaware was defeated by a substantial margin. I think she's a straight to Fox. I don't think anybody is going to think she has a political future, but she may well have a talk radio or TV future.
As indeed you do, Bruce Shapiro. Thank you for that. I want you to remain on as our pilot as we sail into uncharted waters. Bruce Shapiro, Exec Director, Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University. LNL on ABC Radio National, et cetera. Coming up, Judge John Smallwood. Okay, I'm not going to go through what happened last time, but we did have a very unpleasant program segment on this topic, and it's very kind of Judge John Smallwood, who's a county court judge who presides over the County Courier Court in Victoria, to join us from the same Melbourne TARDIS where all that unhappiness erupted. Welcome to Late Night Live, John. I'm most grateful.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. No problems.
You've said elsewhere that the Courier Court system has nothing to do with liberal notions of uplifting Aborigines. In fact, let me quote you, the North Bourne aren't we good to the blackfellas types. They mean well, but it's bullshit.
Yes.
Talk to that.
What we're endeavouring to do with the County Courier Court is also the same with the Magistrates Courier Court in Victoria. The County Courier Court's been going for about 2 years. What we're endeavouring to do is make it just extremely pragmatic. There can be a lot of, and there is a lot of talk about what can be done for Aboriginal people and the like, and what we're endeavouring to do is actually have some effect in a very pragmatic way. Now, what occurs is that people will say things and make generalisations, which are all very well-meaning, but in the end result don't assist anybody. And we're, with a small unit, and just a number of judges and some elders, trying to make a do it very pragmatically and actually have an effect.
So you're trying to wind back that sort of over overpraise, in a sense.
Yeah, it's really of no assistance to us. That approach is very important in terms of overall attitudes to all Aboriginal people, programs and the like. But with the court itself, we've taken the view that it's very pragmatic and it has to be made to work. So we're not particularly concerned with motherhood statements, that type of thing. It's really, you know, how do we make this thing work?
How did these courts emerge? Remind the Gladys about their history.
Well, I'm not sure insofar as the other states are concerned, because I'm, at the present time at least, in charge of the Koori Court in Melbourne. Originally came about 10 years ago, discussions commenced in Victoria with a magistrates' Koori Court, which is, as I understand it, the only Koori Court that's actually legislated for. A lot of consultation took place, and the magistrates' Koori Court, and then ultimately a children's Koori Court, were brought into existence. The essential aims, one that's continually hammered, is recidivism, which is only one of the aims that the court's about. It's really a situation of enabling Aboriginal people to participate in their own sentencing process, if you like.
Mm.
Rob Holles has been instrumental in that, and have a large number of other people, county court judges, magistrates, all sorts of people.
So I understand that you focus on offenders who are in great danger of being sent to prison.
In the county court, the probabilities are that they will be.
Right. And the advantages of this court system are?
Yep. The advantages are that, and it's you really have to see it. Can I put it this way? The court's open, and very few people ever avail themselves of coming to watch it. But the advantages are that you can actually see Aboriginal offenders, maybe young, maybe older, 10 years of substance abuse, extraordinarily disadvantaged backgrounds, actually feel as if they're being heard and actually participate in their own sentencing process. And that's the real advantage of it, that you see people literally lift their heads up, particularly with the elders sitting either side. They talk to the elders and engage with the elders rather than the judge. And the advantages of it are that there's a sense of ownership of not only the court in that sense, but of their own offending.
And of course, you blokes come down into the body of the court, don't you? You don't sit up magisterially on high.
No, what occurs is that the accused, this being the county court, is arraigned from on high with robes on the lot to show that it's the white fellas court, if I can put it that way. And then the judge comes down with two elders and we sit at a table and basically have a sentencing yarn. And that enables us to find out a lot more about the offender than we would otherwise be able to.
I take your point that not a lot of white fellas are coming into the courts to see how they work. What about black fellas? Is there a lot of community interest in this process?
What we're trying to do with the County Koori Court is we have like the Jimmy Sharman bus trip where we went up to Orbost and Bairnsdale, just enlightening people. One of the problems you're going to get after 200 years of what they've been put through is that a certain aspect of this is, I think, in some respects seen as native police type concepts. So there's also a view that this will get you a lesser sentence and all sorts of things like that, which will attract interest. Now, those things just aren't correct. But we're finding more and more that Koori people in Victoria, at least, are becoming much more aware of it and much more prepared to participate in it.
Now, let me clarify this. As I understand it, an offender must have entered a guilty plea or have been found guilty in a summary hearing and must consent to have the matter heard in the Indigenous Sentencing Court.
That's right. Now, we hear appeals from the magistrates' court. There's not that many of those. But we will not deal with a matter unless the offender has in fact pleaded guilty and accepted responsibility. We don't deal with any form of sexual offending, and we don't deal with any forms of pursuant to the Crimes Family Violence legislation. So those we don't do. The person must consent and must accept responsibility and plead guilty.
How important are the roles of the elders or respected persons, capital R, capital P, who sit in on these cases with you?
Absolutely crucial. What we've found is that with the Koori Court, the County Koori Court's only been going now for about a year and a half or 2 years, but in interviews that have been done by some evaluators with people who've been sent to prison, who've been otherwise dealt with by the County Koori Court, they're able to tell the evaluators what the elders said to them in that process. They haven't got a clue what the judge said, but you're dealing with people, as I say, decade of substance abuse who for the first time in their lives can actually remember what occurred in the court hearing. Now, that's because the elders are able to relate to them and confront them with their own offending. One of the misconceptions, which is very hard to get around because people just keep repeating it to me, is that there's some form of traditional punishment, customary law. Well, those things just don't occur.
I was trying to get onto that in our last discussion, but it was
it was
derailed.
And I didn't hear the discussion, Philip, but I heard of it. Okay, put it that way.
But the there's a widespread attitude which I keep hearing, and it all boils down to a spear in the thigh.
Yeah, it's wrong. That is not what happens. And I make this very clear. We do not apply customary law in any way, shape or form, either in the County Kerry Court or the Magistrates Court. We do not impose traditional punishments. The elders have nothing to do with the actual sentence that's imposed. They're there to confront the offender about his offending and to get information for the judge, and you do not get a discount of your sentence for appearing in the Kerry Court. Simple as.
And if I was sitting there, I would see you finally don your wig and gown when sentencing.
That's
and
right.
Return to the bench to emphasise that the elders are not involved in the choice of punishment.
That's right. Yep. To make absolutely certain that what I do, and I know other judges do it as well, is that it's really only a change in procedure. There's no change in the law. The sentencing rules and that are all the same. But what I do, and I know other judges do it as well, who sit in the Kerry Court, when we go down to sit at the table, I will address the young fella or young woman who's sitting opposite me and say, look, you're going to get a whack here, you know that. It's a white fella's whack, it comes from me. The elders are here to assist, to get information I might otherwise not get and to tell me things I might otherwise not understand, but they play no part in the actual sentence itself. That's explained very clearly. And what you tend to find, this is a bit of an experience for me, is that the offender will then make eye contact with the elders and the judge just goes out of the picture. The communication after that is with the elders, not me. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me identify you. You are Judge John Smallwood,
yep.
County Court Judge, Kerry Court in Victoria, and this is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and other platforms. Okay. The one of the claims made by your many critics is that this is a soft option, that offenders can plead guilty and get a lighter sentence. Is that the way it, you know, I would be quite sympathetic to that happening, but is that what does happen?
No. What occurs is that because they're participating in that process, we find out more about them, so that it can be that with more information, motive as to why crimes were committed, that type of thing, they may end up with a lighter sentence than they may otherwise have got. But just in recent times, the statistics, and I'm not a great believer in statistics, Philip, I can assure you, but the statistics tend to show that in Kerry Court, you are 50% more likely to be imprisoned and likely to be imprisoned for a significantly longer period of time than you are in mainstream. You're twice as likely to get a suspended sentence. You're twice as likely to get a community-based order. So the actual dispositions that are imposed are, on a percentage statistical basis, higher than in mainstream. Now, there's reasons for that, because we're dealing with people with extended criminal histories and all sorts of things, but to describe it as a soft option, again, statistically, and as I say, I'm not a great believer in statistics, that's just wrong. We give people in the county court, we're giving people 3, 4, 5 years.
Are the victims of crime also able to appear in Kerry Court cases?
Yeah, they certainly are. In the county court, we have had very few victims actually appear. Now, I suspect, and this is just my theorising, that the reason for that is that we don't deal with sexual offending. My experience in mainstream as a county court judge, that the majority of victims who will attend that court, actually physically attend, are the victims of sexual assault. Now, we don't deal with that. What happens in the Kerry Court is that frequently victim impact statements are there and are read out, and indeed, we sit around a table, that type of thing. A number of situations where the prosecutor will actually confront the prisoner, as is about to become sometimes, with what's in the victim impact statement and question them about it. And what do you think about that and how do you feel about that? So it's any victim who wants to come is perfectly entitled to do so and would be welcomed. But as I say, because we don't deal with sexual offences, it's not common. But the victim impact statements are.
John, your AG, Rob Hull, says that this court process has halved reoffending rates in some areas. Now, that claim has been highly contested. What's your view about the process or the wish to reduce recidivism?
Look, the recidivism is where everybody goes with this, and it's only one of a number of factors. All right? Now, the recidivist, what is recidivism for a start off? If you've got people who have been substance abusing for 10 years, who've got dreadful family situations, sitting down with a judge and a couple of elders is not going to stop their offending. Now, as I understand it, they seem to be working this on a basis of, do they offend within the next 12 months? Well, I don't think that's a test at all. We're going to have to look at this, how it applies in 5 or 6 years. Firstly, whether they're still alive, whether they're still offending, how often they've offended, whether the subsequent offending, and you've got to expect that with people, sure, who are so disadvantaged and
well, you'd expect it within the whitefella community at that end of the food chain, wouldn't you?
Well, that's right. And in the county court, of course, we're dealing with serious matters, so they usually come into us with a very extensive history. So I think it's going to be years before we know the ultimate. If we keep them alive, it's a start. And it's not only just whether they reoffend or not. What we have found, and these statistics are accurate, I believe, that the non-appearance rate has been reduced dramatically. I mean, no courier is going to turn up to a court to be helped. And when they're turning up at least to a courier court, they do turn up. So the fail-to-appear rate is significantly reduced. The breach of community-based orders is significantly reduced. Those matters are for certain. If they offend again, I've got a strong view that if we can at least have them offending in a lesser way, that's important. There's all these other aspects of them confronting their own offending. All those aspects get rolled up into it. I know from talking to blokes like Alan Thorpe, who run men's programs inside the jail and the like for Aboriginal men, that quite a number of them just don't quite see what they've done wrong. Even in violent situations, that's just the way they've been. And to get them to acknowledge that, hey, there's something wrong with this, that's a flying start in itself. So I think there's an obsession with this word recidivism, whatever it really means, which distracts, I think, from what we're really about.
Now, the first of these courts was established in Adelaide, 11 years ago, in Victoria in 2002,
yep,
and they've been rolling out. Do you have time to talk to your brother and sister judges in the other states to compare notes on the effectiveness?
No, the only time I've done that's today, to be brutally frank. In the county court one, we've obviously had the experience. I was talking to Ian Gray yesterday. I had lunch with him, but a lot of communication with the magistrates' courts. We're the only indictable or trial court that does it in Australia, so that our experiences are very different because we're dealing with much more serious offending. The likelihood of being imprisoned is probably 10 times in our court what it is in a magistrates' court. So when I see people, we talk about it. Kate Audie, for example, who was instrumental in Victoria and setting up Currie Court, she's over in Western Australia. I speak to Kate about it and other people. But I think that the standards of what you're judging it by also vary considerably from state to state. I would not like to be an Aboriginal person in Western Australia. I really wouldn't. Mm. I've been talking to a politician from Western Australia today about things that can be done about that, but really different systems. Also, I think, Philip, one of the things that's not understood is that when people say one law for them, one law for us, I mean, the Currie Court in Victoria sits at Morwell. All our clientele come from Morwell. Now, I don't know if you know much about Morwell, but Morwell's a long way from the Tanami Desert. And in terms of what's successful and what you're achieving, it's got to be very much location-based, I think. So we certainly talk about things that are being tried and other judges come over and we yarn about it. But with the County Currie Court, we're in somewhat uncharted waters at the moment.
As you're aware, of the case of a Speedy Morgan being heard in the Currie Court has caused an uproar. Yeah. Repeatedly, violently assaulted a 15-year-old girl with whom he was living, was sentenced in the Currie Court to 3.5 years with a minimum term of 18 months.
Yep.
But interestingly, the Court of Appeal ruled that he was entitled to a lighter sentence because of the shaming he'd received.
Yeah, look, there's been with the case of Morgan, a rather severe misunderstanding. If you read the case of Morgan, it says that the Currie Court is implementing a mixture of common law and customary law, and that shaming is a traditional punishment. Now, we do not do either of those, and you don't get a discount simply for appearing there. One of the problems that the perception that case is saying that we impose somehow traditional punishments was that they then effectively halved what the Currie Court judge had given, even though the Currie Court seems to be being blamed for the end result. And the effect that had, for example, with this type of thing, is that the elders who sat on that case wondered what they'd done wrong. And community members were saying, well, you know, if there's traditional punishment, what do they think they're doing? You know, they've got no, what are they doing? That the sentence was twice as much. They're becoming involved in the sentencing. And the fact of the matter is that they don't. So there's been a severe misunderstanding insofar as the case of Morgan's concerned. And there's a lot of aspects about Morgan which I couldn't really discuss on air in a situation like this. But, for example, Morgan originally was charged with a number of sexual offences. The girl was 15. So to describe it as a domestic situation when the sexual relationship, he's also pleaded guilty to a count of kidnapping, involved sexual offending which had to be or couldn't be proceeded with later on for a number of reasons, puts it into very much a category of its own. And whether Morgan would, if it came up today, be dealt with in the Koori Court, we've got a discretion, is somewhat debatable. But that's the difficulty with it, that... And I suppose that's part of the well-meaning aspect of it, that we just don't do those things, but there's a perception that that's what we're doing.
Well, look, John, I thank you for that. You've clarified a lot of issues. The listeners wanted to hear about this court and were not given the chance to do so. And I thank you for your time. Judge John Smallwood, thanks for coming in. LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, et cetera. And after a bit of music, we're going to look at the legacy of the Queensland Aboriginal Administrator. Well, as I said, we're going to the other side of the Rabbit Proof fence. We're going from WA to Queensland. 9 weeks ago, the death of Queensland's equivalent Aboriginal administrator to A.O. Neville died at the age of 88. And his death went largely unnoticed. Yet for almost 40 years, Patrick Killoran was responsible for the welfare of Queensland's Aboriginal population. He oversaw the forced removal of Indigenous people from their land, the detention, the separation of children from parents, and the commandeering of Indigenous wages, savings, and even child endowment payments. Now, Dr. Ross Kidd is an historian and a specialist on Queensland Aboriginal affairs. Ross is the author of The Way We Civilise, which covers the years of Killoran's time as the head of Native Affairs, and her latest book is called Trustees on Trial, which focuses on the failure of Queensland governments to act on evidence of a systematic underpayment of fraud and suspect dealings with trust monies. And Ros joins me from her home outside of Brizzy. Ros, welcome to the program.
Hello, Philip.
Now, he dies 9 weeks ago. There's been almost no mention of it in the papers or in State Parliament. To what extent were he and Neville comparable figures?
I think it was quite a close comparison because they each in their way acted basically as dictators over several decades. There was very little interaction with other departments. And so both of these men ran the field as they thought should be run. They ran natives and told the natives what to do. They gave the orders. They removed people. They sent them to work and took their money and were really, in a sense, I argue now, answerable almost to no one.
Bob Catter, of whom I'm surprisingly fond, described his regime as evil. And we'll get to Bob's involvement later. But while some of the things that Killoran did were notorious, it's true that his department was chronically short of money, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it's probably the case across all states and the territory that Aboriginal Affairs was always very low down in the pecking order. And I can concede that having read thousands of letters of the department and what was happening, but if we're going to weigh that up, we also then have to say, why did he not fight for more?
Well, you found no evidence, did you, of him doing much fighting at all?
No. He was very, very close to Joe Bjelke-Petersen, and I suppose he didn't want to rock the boat. He was probably the most powerful bureaucrat between 1963 and 1986, when he finally left, in inverted commas. And I didn't see him rocking any of the boats. And what happened effectively was that he dipped into the Aboriginal, their private savings and trust funds, and manipulated those to make up shortfalls, but also he took it out on Aboriginal communities by sacking hundreds of workers when the proverbial hit the fan and they had to start paying proper wages.
Of course, you and I both know that over many, many years, the Ministry for Aboriginal Affairs, or whatever it was called at the time in Canberra, was not a highly pursued job. It was often seen as the most poisoned of chalices. Mm. And this bloke in Queensland wouldn't have been fighting off contenders, would he?
Well, no, in Queensland it was. I don't say it was an honourable job in his eyes, but it was a very, very powerful one, Philip. Here we only had three men running this department as you know, little Napoleons between 1914 and 1986. And each of those men, like Killoran himself, were blooded in the department at a young age. I mean, he started in the department on Thursday Island at the age of 25.
Okay, so in a sense, you detect some pride in the bloke, and yet...
Oh, absolutely.
And yet he's a bit of a fibber, because in 1995 he claimed in an interview there were no compulsory removals of Indigenous children, to his knowledge. And he was going back to the 30s and the 40s.
Mm.
He would have known that wasn't true.
Absolutely, it wasn't true. And I was in the Human Rights Commission hearing here for the stolen children, which he was, as I understand it, subpoenaed to attend. And he flatly denied that any people had been compulsorily removed from the Mapoon Mission when they wanted to close that down. And that's an absolute lie as well. But, I mean, this wasn't at all unusual, Philip, because there was no outside scrutiny of his little kingdom as he ran it. They fed the media very occasionally, but no media was allowed on any of the communities and until the late 70s, probably. And nobody knew what was happening, so he could say what he liked. He did say what he liked, and what got said in Parliament and what got printed as annual reports had very little to do with the truth often.
Well, let's look at something else he said in that same interview. He said that there were some kids who went to Shawbourg Aboriginal community and I'm quoting, they were put into dormitories but not compulsorily put there.
Yeah, well, that's an absolute lie. I mean, the number of children sent into dormitories across the whole 100-year period, or almost 100 years, was over 3,000 children removed. And a large percentage of those were sent into dormitories. And in his time, I have a graph here. There's a terrific study done by Dr. Mark Copeland in terms of inter-removals, as they are shown on the government's own files. And between 1963 and 1971, when these removals were made into the dormitories, there were over 100 kids in the dormitories, and these are in the years when Killoran was in charge.
I've just found a note here on another similarity between he and Neville in WA. Over there, the government allowed churches to intercept child endowment checks. He also intercepted them, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. They made a fortune out of child endowment. As soon as child endowment came available in 1941, they cut the grants to the missions by the same amount, so effectively that was just cream for consolidated revenue. They then started more vigorously putting all the kids from the age of five into the dormitories and taking that child endowment. And in fact, in Palm Island in the 70s, I found a nice little chat between the superintendents and the fellow at Palm Island, and he had $500,000 of child endowment he was sitting on in Palm Island, and that was in the same year that a survey showed that a vast majority of the kids were severely undernourished.
Let's tell the listener an extraordinary story dating from November the 15th, 1963, when Killoran oversaw the raiding of a mission, Mapoon, where families were turned out of their houses at gunpoint and watched as the houses were then burnt down.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell was going on, and where were they taken afterwards?
Well, what was going on was bauxite, of course. Bauxite had been discovered in the mid-50s there, and when the coalition government got in 1957, they decided to pursue it. They came out with the Comalco Bill in 1958 and they reduced the mission to 0.02% of what it had been at Mapoon, and they decided that it would get closed down. Now, at that time in the late 50s, Killoran was deputy director, and he was operating out of Thursday Island, and he engineered basically the sacking of Mapoon. He was opposed for many years by the head of the Presbyterian Mission Committee up here, Reverend Sweet, who was determined that they would honour the people's view, that they would absolutely refuse to move. This got said time and time again on documents that were signed off by Killoran. But then I found in the letters, it was quite interesting, the terminology on the letters changed, and all of a sudden we had Dear Jim from Pat and Dear Pat from Jim, and I thought, well, when did this start? And what had happened was Killoran had gone over Reverend Sweet's head to deal with the fellow in Sydney, also named Jim, or James, and the fellow in the Sydney Mission Board was very happy to have the place closed down. It was costing them a fortune. And they engineered to shut down the school, to reduce the goods at the store. Killoran said, I'll intercept the child endowment. Of course, he already controlled all the bank accounts.
And so what you see finally mm-hmm. is not a separation of church and state, but a collaboration.
Absolutely.
Working together to quash resistance.
Yes, exactly. They did that. And yet it depended, it wasn't always uniform, because in the 70s, the same Presbyterian church was an absolute thorn in the side of the Queensland government in terms of land rights, which were always looked on as a great communist plot. And it was the communities up at Arakoon and Mornington Island, particularly Arakoon, actually, who led this moving to outstations. The church there said firmly, if this is what the people want, we are right behind them.
Of course, Killoran also manipulated the so-called removal orders, didn't he?
Well, they all did. They all did. All of the men in charge did that. And often the removal orders, I mean, to read them now, they're quite obscene, a lot of them. You know, they will allege that the women were promiscuous or whatever. But in actual fact, when you read the context behind it, which of course people were never told the reasons, it's often not true. But he organised removal of a whole group from Coranda up there near Cairns, which you've probably heard about, and because they started a mission in 1913 and none of the locals would go near it.
So didn't any white fellas ever raise objections to this? Didn't anyone in the Labor Party? Anyone, for God's sake?
Well, this is a problem I get asked, but of course here, Philip, the Labor Party was in power from 1917 to 1957, I think, just about. Except
so we can't,
three
we can't just
three,
point the finger at Joe,
can
we?
We can't go that way, no. It seemed to me, having read so many of the government's own letters and stuff, that really it's a sort of a yes minister thing with power. They love the power, they guard it jealously. It's even a yes minister thing of the more power you've got, the more prestige your department has. And in fact, the fellow before Killoran, O'Leary, and the fellow before him, Blakely, were seen as experts on the national stage. And up here in Queensland, I mean, they fought bitterly to keep any anthropologists out of the state so there wouldn't be an alternative narrative.
Now, following the passage in 75 of the Racial Discrimination Act, Indigenous Australians had to be paid full award wages. There it was. But with the sanction of Joe, Killoran prevented the payment of award wages. How did he justify that?
Well, Cabinet were behind him on it. They had never paid proper wages until 1968. They introduced a cash economy with a wage on the communities, which was 20% below the dole at that time, and of course people were struggling to survive. But several of the unions got involved and got behind some of the workers, and the case was brought by a fellow called Arnold Murger in 1979, a labourer, and that went before the State Industrial Commission. Now the government, it's quite fun in retrospect, Killoran decided he'd take no notice of it. I mean, this was his fiefdom.
Yeah.
And then he offered to sack Murger and sack anyone else. There was 11 others who joined the unions.
Well, now let me introduce or reintroduce Bob Catter.
Mm-hmm.
Because the refusal to pay award wages continued for years and years and years until 86, when Catter, is elected to Parliament, made Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, and Killoran, it would seem, finally met his match.
He did meet his match. It was Katter who stood up to him, but the writing was well and truly on the wall. They had discussed several times in Cabinet that they were breaking state and federal law, but decided they would keep going. This is in the 1980s. By the time Katter stood up in March 86, they had, I think, 9 or 10 unions out against them with cases ready to go. Cabinet had sought, of course, more than once top legal advice from the Crown Solicitor and Senior Counsel, and that legal advice had always been, and the earliest I read was 79, that the ward wages were legally due and binding, that there was no excuse not to be paying them. So they were really just holding out, and Killoran obviously just did not see the writing on the wall.
But he was personally outraged, that Katter would go out and visit communities on his own and actually talk to people.
Well, he would lose the minders, and there was a really funny set of these worried memos about, you know, he's off again, and of course
the minister's on the loose.
He's on the loose. And he's talking to these radicals, you see, which practically drips vitriol, you know. And of course, what these radicals were the leaders in the communities who were saying, "What about human rights?" You know. And so Katter, yes, he did go out and he did speak to them. But having said that, when the legislation went through in 1982 to give the community self-government, it was pushed through without any community consultation in an overnight sitting in true Queensland style. So, you know, some things change and some things don't. But
Yeah. It
certainly changed for Killoran, and that was the end of him. Although I believe he left with the biggest payout.
$500,000, which ain't hay. Yeah, that's
absolutely right. Yes,
it's most extraordinary. Joe must have had many a blue with Katter. I mean, Katter would have had to confront Joe over all this.
Well, what Katter said to Cabinet was that he said he'd been given wrong advice by his senior advisor without giving him a name. But he said, "We are in a position of extreme legal vulnerability, and we're going to either pay through the nose by going to court, or we'll concede and we'll pay a legal rate." Now, by that time, because oddly enough, it was the Fraser government putting financial screws on them from Canberra over many years, by that time they were almost at a ward wage level, but what they had also done was sacked about two-thirds of the ward workforce.
Right.
Because they absolutely refused to budget for any wage rise, and they just sacked the workers, which threw the communities into terrible disarray. Their own managers were saying, "Look, essential services are at risk. People are living in 20 to a house in a derelict house." And the communities that you see today are an outcome of Joe and Killoran's reign.
And we should point out that during this long period, when their money was being stolen from them, the lives of most Aboriginals remained characterised by, yes, hardship, subsistence diet, unsafe water and sanitation, and as you just said, derelict shelter.
Well, that's right, and that was on the communities, which was about half of the population here that were removed to what were missions and reserves, became communities, but the other half of the population, well, some of them were lucky enough to be living mainstream lives, but hundreds and hundreds of people were under the thumb of these compulsory work agreements, where their money didn't even go into their hands. It went straight to the police protectors and got lost.
I think it's fair to say, though, isn't it, that the case of stolen wages resonates today. It's not entirely resolved, is it?
No, it's nowhere near resolved, Philip. I mean, the point is you've got people who, across generations, the big banker who took control of their money never bothered to make sure it was looked after, presided over a system where it knew the money was being lost. I mean, the number of audit reports that said the police fraud is continuing, the adulteration of thumbprints and signatures is continuing. The government itself, it's on their own records, was dipping into all the trust funds. Now, this is legacy for the people alive today, and they're still fighting for it, as you would for your parents' money if they'd been ripped off.
And we're looking at money held in trust. There's an irony, isn't there, from 1897 till 1972.
Well, that's right, and there is a very close parallel case in the US, and which they have won, and which Obama, to give him his credit, has decided to pay through. But there the judge said that this trust was compounded or intensified doubly or triply, actually, firstly because the people never asked to have their money controlled by these authorities, and he said secondly because this money belongs to the poorest people in our nation. So there is a far more intensive obligation, legal obligation is my argument, that the government had to protect this money, and it has never bothered to acknowledge that. Its latest trick in November last year, because we do have a legal case on breach of trust underway, its latest response is to say it's got nothing to do with them, what the police did with the money. Now, the police were their own agents.
Let's acknowledge that Qatar said the Killoran did excellent work in the early years with regard to educating Aborigines. Do you think there's some truth in that?
I can't quite see where he got it from, to be honest. He may have other information than I do. What did happen in 57 was that when the coalition government came in, there was an emphasis on education, and for a while Native Affairs was under the Department of Education, and I think the government decided at long last to put proper trained teachers into the Aboriginal school. Now, this was a very good thing, of course, but it also shifted the cost of funding teachers onto the Education Department and off the Aboriginal Affairs Department. And you may call me a cynic, but this was a huge debate over policing and over many aspects of it. Who's paying the bill? Well, if the cops won't pay the bill, we won't send the police in to sort these riots out.
A few years ago, it was thought that Australia's Indigenous people could follow Native American example and go down the path of a massive class action. Did anything happen with that?
Well, that's my absolute dream, Philip. That was my balloon that I floated, having read about Eloise Cobell.
Yeah, but that's because you're a troublemaker.
Well, I'm determined. It peeves me, to put it politely, that we are still being lied to today, that we are all part of this big lie that the government is doing. And I'm thinking, well, why should they get away with it? I mean, it's bad enough that these terrible things happened long ago, and you can look back and you can say, okay, there were different ways of looking at things and we're not personally responsible. But my personal view is I am responsible for what I know now and for failing to act on it. That's how I feel.
Good on you, Roz. Dr. Roz Kidd, historian and author. Her most recent book is Trustees on Trial, published by Aboriginal Studies Press. Now, tomorrow night on Classic, we go right back to 1991 to an encounter I vividly recall because it took place on a double bed at the Sebel Townhouse. And I was there with Marianne Faithfull. No, Mick wasn't around. Mick had long gone. And we were just chatting about her extraordinary career, you know, from a little dewy-eyed girl with blonde tresses to, if you like, London's version of Lottie Lenya. So that's on Classic tomorrow. I'll be listening to that because it's such a long time ago. And if you want more information about today's program or our past programs or the theme that I've been proposing and you want to comment or vote, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of listeners have, quite literally, visit our website, www.abc.net.au/rn/ Late Night Live. It is now my pleasant duty to thank the team. Carl Passerio, Sasha Fegan, Mudita Diaz, Stephen Crittenden, Lila Schooner, and Paulie Pieskoff. Stick around now. Don't you poke your tongue out at me, Paul Goff. Stick around now on Radio National for the news, and we will see you later. And I've decided I'm not going to jump off the Harbour Bridge.